You're listening to the Buckeye Visualist Podcast Show.
Welcome to the Buckeye Visualist Show, a podcast for members of the Ohio News Photographers Association, which aims to support professional and student visual storytellers. I am your host, Lori King, and thanks for listening. This show is going out to all of the legacy photojournalists in Buckeye Land out there who were lucky enough to be a part of the good old days. I'm talking about the black and white era when we were shooting on cameras that had one shooting mode, and that was manual. I'm talking about when photojournalists really had to know their stuff, like how to set their own ISO and shutter speeds and apertures without an LCD panel and auto and program modes. The days of developing film in a wet lab and sniffing out the fine scent of Kodak Dextol and D76 developer chemicals. Yes, those were a commodity back then, and we had a lot more job security because not everyone had the cameras, the enlargers, the chemicals, and the knowledge of manipulating light like we did. With me on the show today is one of those photojournalism legacies, and we are going to go down memory lane a little bit. I'm talking about Del Omori, a product of Bowling Green State University when it had a photojournalism degree. BGSU, which is just south of Toledo, was then led by the great late Jim Gordon, who took Dale under his wing and guided him to a very successful photojournalism career. Jim was also a longtime editor of the News Photographer magazine back then. He was 82 when he passed away in his Bowling Green home in 2015. Dale spent most of his career at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He was there for 23 years, serving as the Deputy Director of Photography Multimedia until 2012. He is proud to claim that he was the first at the newspaper to shoot and edit video, and he's still at it. He has significant experience as a storyteller that is apparent in all of his work, whether it's a documentary film, a TV spot, or content marketing. Welcome to the show, Dale.
Hey, Lori, thanks for having me.
It's a privilege to go down memory lane with you. I think it's important not to forget our historical roots and where we come from as image makers in a world where everyone is now a photographer because of the phone that we keep in our person nearly every waking moment. If you're a dedicated listener, you probably know I always start off with this loaded question. Are you a Buckeye born and raised?
Yeah, I am actually. I'm actually from a little town outside of Toledo called Walbridge, Ohio, born and raised there. And I've actually spent my whole life in Ohio. I worked in, I went to school at Bowling Green. I worked at, my first job was at a little newspaper outside of Dayton called the Kettering Oakwood Times. It's a little twice weekly. And I worked there for a couple of years. Then I went to the Cincinnati Post and worked there for about 5 years before coming up to Cleveland. So yeah, I've done, three corners of the state, in the northwest, southeast, and now northeast.
I'm always interested in how people will find their path in life. You definitely have a story that I bet a few of our listeners can relate to. When you were going to BGSU, you said you dropped out as a fine arts major because you didn't know what to do with that, but you decided to come back. And as you were looking through the course catalog, you found journalism and Jim Gordon. Can you take us back to that time when he put you on the trajectory to your successful photojournalism career?
Yeah, I was. I originally went to college as a fine arts major. I frankly was not a very good student, but I was kind of disillusioned with the fine arts. I didn't really know what I was going to do with that, and so I dropped out for a bit. And then decided to go back. I worked odd jobs here and there for about a year, and then I decided to go back. I was looking through the course catalog at the time and saw photojournalism, and I really didn't have any experience in journalism or actually take photography at all, but it sounded like fun and sounded interesting, and I just went over to the J school. And Gordon met with me and he says, oh, why do you want to switch? I said, well, sounds like fun. And he kind of laughed his very unique laugh. Everybody can remember that. I wish I could imitate it, but I can't. But and he just said, you're in. And, I was so naive. I was probably 19 at the time. And I thought every school had a photojournalism program. I had no idea what it was about, what the business was about. Like I said, it just sounded like fun. And actually, I was just serendipitous because I think Bowling Green was a very small program and it was very personalized. And I know what I've heard of other programs, say at Missouri at OU, I don't think I would have gotten in. And I think I wouldn't have done work very well either because I didn't know anything about it. So I had met some good friends or I made some good friends while I was there and who kind of took me under their wing and showed me the ropes. Al Fuchs being one of them. He was the same year as me. He had a lot of experience prior to coming to college. And so he really helped me out a lot. And as well as a guy named Dean Keffler and Mark Oberst. And actually, I think it was my sophomore or junior year, I lived with three other photographers. So I learned a lot just by immersion, basically. But again, I felt lucky to have gone there because it was a small program. And Jim Gordon was kind enough to let me in and kind of showed me the ropes.
What was he like back then?
You know, I never got an A from him ever. He was a tough grader. He was, he didn't throw around compliments very easily. But he was never malicious about it, but he was just very, he had high standards and he expected a lot from you. But he always did it with good humor. I will say that.
You never got an A from him. That's funny.
No, never.
Well, I know OU used to be tough too. I mean, Jeremy Wadsworth, who was a coworker of mine at Tiller Blade, he said that they would actually rip up your black and white prints if they didn't like them. I mean, I teach photojournalism now, but I would never do that.
Yeah, I don't think he ever ripped up any of our prints. Some of them might have popped off the mounting board just because we I was in a hurry and late for class or something like that. But no, he wasn't. You know, I never felt like he was malicious. He was always pretty constructive. But again, he had high standards and I think he really pushed us.
Well, he is an Ohio legend for sure and an NPPA legend as well. He was a lifelong member of NPPA and we were lucky to have him here in Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. He taught me a lot about the business and I think everybody needs someone like that. At least I did back in the day because I really had no direction. I had no clue as to what the business was about. He had a lot of patience with me, quite honestly.
Do you remember your first camera?
I do. I remember taking his photojournalism 306 class with my sister's. I borrowed my sister's Sears. I can't remember the model number, but it had a 50 millimeter lens. And it was just a basic 35 millimeter camera from Sears. And I think it was actually a rebranded Pentax K1000, I think is what it actually was.
You mentioned that your first job was at the Kettering Oakwood Times in Kettering, Ohio. The newspaper is a small suburban newspaper, but it had a great tradition of churning out award-winning photojournalists. Can you do a bit of name dropping?
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky to land that job. It didn't pay a lot of money, but I almost considered it like graduate school. A photographer by the name of Mike Fender was there, and he's the one that hired me. We had a really small staff. I believe we had like four reporters, a copy editor, and an editor. But we had two photographers. I mean, I think that was kind of unheard of back in the day. But so the ratio from reporter photographer was pretty good. Mike Fender was there and he had worked with another photographer by the name of Pat Tehan, who later, Pat's a wonderful photographer and just recently retired in the last couple years from the San Jose Mercury News. And before that, there was Lou Stamp worked there way back in the day before I was there.
Didn't he end up at the Akron Beacon Journal?
Yeah, right. So Lou had a long career at the Akron Beacon Journal. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, from what I understand, it had a really long tradition that started with a guy named, I want to say David Griffin, who redesigned the paper. He was an OU graduate student, I think, and redesigned the paper. But they had a great tradition of hiring young, hungry photographers. And I think Tehan won back when they had a clip contest. He won the region four photographer of the year while he was there. And then Fender won it a couple times as well. So they kind of set up the tradition. When you're there, we published Wednesdays and Saturdays. And every Wednesday, they had a page called the Dimension page. And you had to do a picture story. And oftentimes we wrote the story ourselves. And you had to come up with the idea. You had to lay it out. Oftentimes you had to fill the front of the section as well as the next page. So you had all two open pages really to fill. So you had to do that every week, and there was two of us. So we would just alternate. But it was great training ground, and it was a great learning experience. If you had a page one picture and you printed it to five columns, that's what they would run it as, a five column picture. So you printed to whatever size you wanted that picture to run, and generally they would run it. So we were really spoiled, quite honestly.
Oh yes, those were the days.
I mean, really, this will really date myself, but I think my first year I made $175 a week. And then after a year, I think I got a raise to $185 a week. And my rent was $190 a month. So that shows you how long ago that was.
You have won a few big photo contests during your career, including a nomination by the Plain Dealer for a Pulitzer Prize in feature photography.
I kind of laugh at those nominations I put it on my resume, but someone asked me about that. I said, you know, getting nominated by your newspaper for a Pulitzer Prize is like having your mom say you did a good job, right? So, anyhow.
Did you have a certain beat that you liked to be on? Were you a sports shooter? Did you like feature photography? Portraits?
Right. I have to say, I think as a newspaper photographer, and I don't know, I'll just speak for myself, I was like not really that great at any one thing. I was okay at a lot of things. I mean, you're a jack of all trades. Could I shoot sports? Was I the best short sports shooter at the paper? No, not by a long shot. I mean, I could cover a high school game. I could do okay. Spot news, it was just, I was a generalist. I liked doing picture stories. A lot of that stemmed from working at the Kettering Oakland Times, because I had to do so many of them. So I was pretty good at picture stories. I don't think in portraiture, my portraiture is okay. It's not great. So I think I was like a lot of newspaper photographers. We're generalists and you're expected to do a competent job in a lot of different things. And I think I could do that. I like to think I was, I was a pretty good journeyman newspaper photographer. I don't think I was a standout. Actually, at the Plain Dealer, in the 90s and the early 2000s, we had really a great staff and really had to pedal pretty fast to keep up. We had a lot of great shooters I was definitely not the top dog.
Who were some of the top dogs at the Plain Dealer back then?
Oh, I think Mike Levy comes to mind. Later, a woman by the name of Lisa DeYoung, wonderful photographer. Chris Stevens, who I always admired, was a great photographer and probably one of the most modest people I've ever met, but really someone who had just such a gift, truly. I always admired her work. So yeah, we had a lot of really good photographers. John Koontz, Josh Gunter. We had a ton of really good photographers.
And a lot of photographers compared to what they have now, which is probably nil.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they have now. It's all Cleveland.com. I think Josh Gunter and John Koontz are still there. And Dave Anderson. Dave Anderson was a great photographer. Now he does mostly video, I think, for Cleveland.com. But I think at the peak, I think we had 17 or 18 photographers. And then we had maybe four or five picture editors.
Wow.
So it's changed a lot.
Yeah, I think our job hasn't changed a lot. Jack of all trades, we do a little bit of everything, but the way we disseminate it has changed. The camera equipment is changing. We're doing more for less.
Yeah, I don't know how people make a living doing it now. I think I don't know where the jobs are, put it that way. And I'm kind of out of touch with the editorial work. But from what I do see and what I see online and Instagram and whatever, there's a ton of talent out there. There's a ton of great images being made. I will say that. I know, even with people using the phone, that really nice stuff. So I think the whole profession, as far as number of images, quality of images, to me, I think it's all gone up. I think it's all getting better. I think as a commodity, it's been cheapened because there's so much of it out there. And there's so many people doing it. And I think, it used to be a barrier to entry was, could you afford the equipment? Could you afford the film? Did you have to know how to, print your pictures and all that? And now it's become much more accessible. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it makes it harder for people to make a living at it, for sure. But is it a bad thing as far as journalism goes? I don't know. I really don't know. I would not automatically say, yes, it's worse. Because I think, you know, democratization, the way I look at it, is kind of democratization of the medium. A lot more people can be photographers now. I mean, the equipment's more affordable. You don't have to, you know, constantly buy film. You don't have to find a dark room. You don't have to buy photo paper. And I think the cameras are, geez, much better. And I think all that's good. I mean, the very reason why there's more photographers is the same reason why I got into film and why I make videos is because I didn't have to go to film school. I didn't have to, you know, learn how to shoot on 35 millimeter film for video to make a film, right? So I don't necessarily see it as a bad thing. I see it as, I do wonder how people make a living. I mean, before it was, you know, if you wanted to be in photojournalism, I mean, there were jobs out there at newspapers, but, you know, I don't know where those are now.
I was going to ask you to tell us about life after the Plain Dealer. What have you been up to lately?
So, well, I'll back up a little bit. So while I was at the Plain Dealer, there was a time when all newspapers wanted to go into video and wanted to, you know, go into multimedia. And so I embraced that when I was there. I had been shooting pictures. I had been kind of on the streets for a long time as a photographer. And I just wanted to do something different. I felt like I was kind of doing the same thing over and over again. And so I thought, to me, it was kind of like the Wild West as far as newspapers go with multimedia and video. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. I'd love to, right? Simultaneously, I had gotten together with some photographer friends of mine outside of work. And we recruited a couple of reporters that I knew. And we formed a little film company and we made a couple documentaries, which we got into the film festival. I already had an interest in, so when the Plain Dealer asked me, I said, sure, I'll do it. And so I started off doing like audio slideshows like we all did, right? And I love those, doing my own interviews. The other thing I liked about it was now I was not dependent on a reporter. I could kind of go out and do my own thing. I didn't have, you know, I could do my own interviews. I could edit my own piece. And I love doing that. And I love editing video. I know a lot of people will hate it, but I loved it. I thought that's where you could really shape your story. So I was doing that at the Plain Dealer. Towards the end, I mean, they were talking layoff, they were having layoffs and you just knew things were not going well. And I got a call from a big advertising firm in Cleveland. And a former colleague of mine, a reporter, was working there, and they were starting a new project and bringing on a new client. And they needed someone with some editorial chops as far as filmmaking goes. They had a production studio and they had some really great people working there, but they didn't really have any editorial chops. It was mostly advertising. And so they asked me to come on for this project. And I said, sure, I did. And then, so they hired me as a producer director. And I loved it. I was not there long. I was there for about 20 months and for various reasons, but I learned a ton. I learned a lot about really what high-end production looks like, what it takes to make it. But I also learned that, you know, there was kind of a niche that I saw in the market that didn't require a big production crew. If you knew what you were doing, I thought there was a lot of business to be had there. After about 20 months, I just said, well, I'm going to go out on my own and started my own thing. So that's what I did.
Which is what? What is your own thing?
So right now, I'm really a freelancer, but I have my own media production or video production company called Omori Media. And I do a lot of work in healthcare, a lot of documentary based pieces. I'm kind of like a general contractor in the construction trades, right? So it's like if I have a project, rarely work alone. I always have another shooter with me. And oftentimes we'll bring in an audio guy. And editing wise, if I need motion graphics or a drone, I'll hire that out on any given project. So that's kind of what I do. And probably 90% of my work is in healthcare right now.
So you need to be a businessman as well.
Yeah. And part of that I credit being able to do that is working at the advertising agency. You learn about business, which you never learned at the newspaper. So you have to be a bit of a businessman too. It's actually pretty simple. It's like, you know, just make more than you spend, basically.
You and Harlan Specter had a film selected for the 2022 Chagrin Documentary Film Festival in the Local Documentaries category for the film American Heartbreak. You also entered American Dinner, which was about your mom. Can you please tell us about those two films?
Kent State, the American Heartbreak was about Kent State. And American Dinner was a little memoir and a little homage to my mom who passed in 2020. But that was just a little thing about my family, autobiographical. But American Heartbreak was about kind of the hero, for lack of a better way to characterize him, of Kent State, if there were a hero during that 1970 shooting. He was the professor that convinced the kids. So after this shooting, what a lot of people don't realize is the protesters weren't going to leave. They were upset and they were angry at what happened at the shootings. And so they were going to stay. And the guards' orders were to move them out. And the fear was that they've already shot 9 kids and killed 4 of them. And they still wanted to move the protesters out. So what were they going to do? And the protesters weren't going to move. But it turns out that there was this beloved geology professor who was a peace marshal, a faculty peace marshal at the time. And he was there and he made this impassioned plea. And because he was so beloved and trusted, that the kids actually listened to him and they actually moved away. There's some speculation. Of course, it's all speculation of what would have happened had they not moved. Some people say, you know, he may have saved hundreds of lives that day by his actions. And the gist of it was, is that event haunted him the rest of his life. And he was really, if you read his story or even watch a little bit of the film, he was a true American. I mean, a great patriot in the very best sense of the word. He was not ideological. He just wanted to know why this happened. Why is anybody pointing guns at my students? And he was, you know, he was a former Marine. He was a township trustee. He was of the establishment, but I think he felt like at that time and that's why we named the film what we did, was his heart was broken by his government. What he saw, the actions they took that day. So
I watched those two films and I loved them.
Oh, thanks.
What is it about filmmaking that you love so much?
Number one, I think it's, as a newspaper photographer, I mean, you're pretty siloed, right? I mean, you report as well, but you're reporting with a camera. It kind of stems from my training at the Kettering Oakwood Times, quite honestly, I think. At Kettering, like for those picture pages, oftentimes you wrote the story, you shot the pictures, you did the layout, you did everything. And I kind of miss that control. And so when I make films, it's like you still have that control. Even if I collaborate with Harlan, right, or with somebody else, it's like oftentimes I end up doing the editing, which is where the film is really shaped. And I like that control. I think it's as I tell people, it's way more art than science. I think every editor has different sensibilities and how you want that story to feel and how you want it to progress. And I think that's what I love about filmmaking. I think, and in a way it has a power that I think print does not, you know, and I came to it late in my career. Had I known way back in the day, I might've switched my careers long ago, but, but I did take a documentary film class in college. We were editing on Betamax or whatever. It was tape to tape and is linear editing. And if you've ever done that, it's quite tedious. And I thought, I will never, ever do this for a living.
Sounds brutal.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal. But you know what? I was always kind of fascinated by the power of film and the power of multimedia. So
what equipment do you use for your filmmaking and what software do you use to edit it on?
Yeah, I use Final Cut, the new Final Cut, which is rare, most professionals don't, but I can use Premiere. I can do a little bit in After Effects. And for shooting, I shoot like with a Canon C300, which is a cinema camera. And then for B-roll, in just the last couple of years, I shoot B-roll with, I have a couple Canon mirrorless R5s, which are really nice. And, you know, it's like, We have a gimbal. I haven't done a drone. I always hired that out. But that's what I'm using now. And, you know, as far as lights, I've switched to LEDs and use softboxes very similar to what you would for stills. And microphones. I have a Shep's shotgun mic. I use that for interviews. And, you know, just the typical stuff everybody uses, really. I think the 300 is probably, most people don't use that. Every year the cameras have way more capability and get better and better. So, and cheaper and cheaper.
Do you have any advice for aspiring filmmakers? Because you know they're listening.
Yeah, well, you know, I would say my advice to most young photographers and filmmakers really is to just kind of concentrate on honing their storytelling skills. I think, you know, the technology you can learn and your eye will develop and your editing skills will develop as you do more. But I think, you know, just having a good grasp of what a good story is and how to tell a good story is really the part of it that's a little bit more elusive at times, I think. It's a little harder to learn. And I think experience just informs that skill even more than the others, quite honestly.
Let's talk about ONPA for a second. You were ONPA POI twice while you were working at the Plain Dealer. You were also a clip contest winner a few times, and you won the Ohio Understanding Award 3 times. That's quite an accomplishment. Back in the day, it was a strong state organization. I think it still is, and I think it's still relevant. Can you make a case for being a member today, especially as a young photojournalist?
Yeah, you know, I will say ONPA was, you know, played a big part in my career, especially when I was starting out. It was a chance to see, especially if you go to the contest judging, the judging used to be open at Ohio State when it was in Prince, and it was a day-long affair. And it was, as a young guy, it was great to go see what was considered good. You got to meet a lot of other photographers, and you got to rub elbows with a lot of, you know, veterans who you know, had been in the business a while, and that was really instructive. And the conventions, I didn't go to a lot of them. I went more when I was younger, but I remember one of the best conventions I went to, the keynote speaker was Harry Benson, who was a great photographer. He has like historic photos. And he was very, very funny. And his pictures were outstanding. And it just left a big impression on me, especially as a young photographer. I think it was really formative, actually. Another thing is the contest back in the day, you know, carried a lot of weight within our office. Like if you won that, I mean, you know, it's like it meant, you know, professionally within that staff, you probably tended to get better projects, better assignments. So, and it was very competitive within our staff as well. You know, most of the time that was a good thing. Sometimes it got a little out of hand, but I think we all took it a little too seriously, myself included. Back in the day, it was a great organization, and I think they really helped set the standard as the quality of work done in the state. As a young photographer starting out, it's nice to talk to other professionals, see how they approach work, and see what other people are considered, what other work is considered good. I think that, you know, styles change and sensibilities change. And so it's interesting to keep up on what other people and what other newspapers or what other journalists are doing.
That's the one organization that links us together.
Right, exactly. And some people you would only see like once a year. And it would be at that. Yeah, there is a real community there. And this is all before social media. So it's not like you kept in touch. I mean, you'd run into other people on other assignments here and there, but it was the social media of the time, I guess. I always kind of have a soft spot in my heart for that organization.
Yeah, I'm hoping that they have state chapters at the universities like Kent State and OU, just because I think getting students involved and they become staffers and freelancers, and if they become members, that's going to grow the ONPA membership.
You know, I think it'd be great to get younger people involved. There was a student contest when I was a member, and when I was in college, I remember entering that. But I thought it was a great organization. But I, again, the backbone of it was newspapers. I know most of them are diminished a lot from what they used to be. So,
yeah, I think that they realize that the backbone is newspapers, and I think they're making an effort to include broadcast journalists in there as well.
They always had broadcast involved back in the day, I thought.
Yeah, they do, but they're making a more concentrated effort, I think, to include them in the program. Yeah, I know I am as a podcaster. I keep, wanting, the first 6 ones I've done of the Buckeye Visualist podcast were newspaper photographers. And then I realized when I was talking to a friend of mine who was a TV photographer, I'm like, holy cow, I just left you guys out, completely didn't even think of you. So I'm trying to make an effort. That's why I was so excited to see you pop up on, I think it was on Twitter, and that you were a filmmaker. And it's like, I need to reach out to you. So thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, that delineation gets more blurry
every year.
Newspaper photographers are asked to shoot video, and TV guys are asked to shoot stills all the time. So I remember being on an assignment when I was shooting video, and the TV guy looks at me and is like, what the heck are you doing? And I, at the time, really didn't have any idea. But I will say this, too. When I was first starting out in video at the Plain Dealer, and I knew a lot of the local TV guys from just being on assignment with them, they couldn't have been nicer. They're super helpful. Just little things like, how do you plug into a malt box? I had no clue. I wasn't even really sure what a malt box was. But they were super helpful, and I was so appreciative because, it was like you're doing what they're doing, and they're looking at you like, but they didn't take offense, and they were like, yeah, whatever help you need, they were happy to help.
That just gave me an idea to pitch maybe doing webinars on how to do things, like technical things, how to set up lights, the malt box, and.
Yeah, do a thing on audio. Audio is the bane of everybody's existence, trust me.
Mm.
Audio is tough.
Good idea. Well, thank you, Del Amore, for joining me on the Buckeye Visualist podcast. Your story has historical significance that we now have on record, and good luck with your film career.
Oh, well, thanks so much, and thanks for having me. It was fun.
You're welcome. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Buckeye Visualist. I am your host, Lori King. Keep an FQ.8 mind, everybody.
You've been listening to the Buckeye Visualist podcast.